health system in Gaza that has been devastated by weeks-long Israeli bombardments. The organization warned that more people could die from diseases than bombings in Gaza if the system is not put back on its feet rapidly. The WHO described the collapse of the Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza as a tragedy. Israel has repeatedly bombed hospitals in Gaza throughout its brutal war. Meantime, the international charity Save the Children has called for a full ceasefire in Gaza, warning that a failure to agree on a ceasefire would cost thousands of more lives. The charity says that without a complete ceasefire, Gaza's children will be left to live through a nightmare once again. Israel has pounded the besieged Gaza Strip in violation of an extended truce deal with Hamas movement. Tanks fired at Sheikh Radwan, a district in northwest of Gaza City. The regime also launched artillery attacks on the besieged territory. Al-Ghassan Brigade says it's dealt with an Israeli violation earlier today in the northern Gaza Strip. It urged the mediators to pressure the Israeli regime to adhere to all the terms of the truce. The Gaza Health Ministry, meanwhile, says the regime keeps denying hospitals fuel for their generators. That's in violation of the ceasefire. The 4-day truce came into effect on Friday after nearly 7 weeks of constant bombardment of Gaza. The airstrikes took the lives of more than 15,500 Palestinians, mostly women and children. Officials say that 7,000 people remain unaccounted for. The Gaza truce deal also includes exchange of prisoners between Hamas and Israel. As part of the agreement, more Palestinian prisoners have been released from Israeli jail. Thirty-three Palestinians were freed from an Israeli jail in the occupied West Bank on Monday. Hamas said it's released 11 Israeli captives. That was the fourth phase of prisoner exchange under the temporary truce deal. On the same day, the two sides also agreed to extend the ceasefire until Wednesday. Hamas says it's reached an agreement with Israel to release 10 captives in return for 30 Palestinians. It's expressed hope that the truce could be extended for a longer period. Under the truce, Hamas has released a total of 69 captives, while Israel has freed 150 Palestinian detainees. Now, many of the Palestinians released from Israeli jails under the Gaza truce deal were children, but hundreds more remain locked away. Now, the next report by Iran's Al Alam Network will hear two released children and their family members talk about their plight in Israeli jails and their appreciation of the resistance groups who secured their freedom.
I arrived home with a two-day delay because the Israeli army was attacking the Jenin refugee camp. It's difficult to travel from Ramallah to here because there are so many checkpoints. But thank God, I finally arrived home. After the war on Gaza started, Israeli guards would beat us up in jail and swear at us and fire tear gas at us. Thank God that we were released. I hope the resistance fighters stay safe, and God willing, they will soon celebrate victory.
We are grateful to the resistance fighters. God willing, they will achieve victory against the enemy and secure the release of the rest of the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails.
The conditions were difficult for us after October 7. The Israeli guards would storm our cells and take our clothes. They also cut our food rations.
I have the indescribable feeling of a mother who sees his son after months of imprisonment. Thanks be to God for the breakthrough. We were afraid of the sentences that were due to be handed down. My son was freed in return for the blood of 14,000 Gazan martyrs.
The Israeli onslaught in Gaza has brought almost all vital infrastructure in the besieged strip to a standstill. People are desperate for food, water, and electricity, and some residents recount their sufferings caused by the war. Let's take a listen.
We came to fill with clean water. Where there's a truce, or now we still have no electricity, no water, and none of basic necessities. Look how people are standing in line to get some water. Sometimes we wait until late at night to get to our turn. There are many problems. The economic situation is hard. We want the situation to be solved. We are fed up with the lack of water and using fire. There's no gasoline, no electricity, and nothing. Pray for us. That's all I can say.
The struggle for water happens daily since we were first displaced until now. Even during the ceasefire, they didn't find a solution to the water problem. There should be a solution for the water. They said that they have allowed in fuel and aid, but nothing changed. The suffering is the same and getting worse. I call for the extension of the truce and to have a full ceasefire because the people are exhausted, truly exhausted. People are struggling badly to get life's basic needs. The building blocks of life are done. What else do they have? What are they waiting for? For the rest of us to die? What next? It's over.
Now, medics in Gaza have witnessed heart-wrenching scenes caused by Israel's airstrikes and shellings. They struggle to save lives at medical facilities while facing shortages of fuel and medicine due to both the attacks and the regime's full blockade. Let's now listen to a British Palestinian surgeon recounting what he saw and experienced in Gaza. He was speaking at a news conference in London.
One of the most horrific scenes that I witnessed in Shifa Hospital was when, after the air raid and the dead and the wounded were brought in, members of the Shifa medical staff and nursing staff would be running frantically in the emergency department, looking at the faces of the wounded and the dead to see whether their relatives had been amongst the wounded, and in many cases their children had been amongst the dead and the wounded. During my time at Shifa Hospital, it became apparent that 40 to 45% of all the wounded were going to be children. That there were the primary target of the bombing was people's residential homes.
After the attack on Ahli Hospital, I had to take a patient out who had a penetrating neck injury on a stretcher, and I walked into the forecourt of the hospital where the missile had landed. There are lots of bodies lying there, and I remember to my right, as I was carrying the stretcher with three other paramedics, that there was an amputated arm of a child, a forearm of the child on the floor.
Israeli troops have killed three more young Palestinians in their fresh raids on several areas across the occupied West Bank. The regime forces killed Malik al-Barghouti by live fire in the village of Kafr Ain, west of Ramallah. Also, the Palestinian Health Ministry reported a killing of Yassin Abdullah al-Asmer in a raid on the town of Beitounia, also near Ramallah. Another youth, aged 23, sustained injuries there. 14-year-old Ahmed Jamil Wahdan was also killed in a village east of Tubas in northeastern West Bank. The Israeli regime has ramped up attacks across the occupied West Bank since October 7. That's when Hamas launched a surprise operation against the Israeli regime. Ever since, nearly 230 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. Hamas resistance movement has released a letter by an Israeli captive addressed to the fighters who accompanied her during a period of captivity in the Gaza Strip.
Thanks to you, and thanks to other kind people we met along the way, my daughter considered herself a queen in Gaza. And in general, she acknowledges the feeling of being the center of the world. We haven't met a person on our long journey, from the military to the leadership, who did not treat her with gentleness, care, and love. I will forever be a captive of gratitude because she did not leave this place with a lasting psychological trauma.
In the letter, Danielle expresses her gratitude to her captors on behalf of herself and her daughter, Amelia. She describes their treatment at the hands of Hamas fighters as extraordinary and calls their humanity unparalleled. Now, other released Israeli captives also earlier testified to the good treatment they had received while in Hamas captivity. After being released on humanitarian grounds, an 85-year-old Israeli woman said that Hamas fighters provided all the needs of the captives and gave them the same food they themselves had. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for a further boosting of the combat readiness of the Iranian Navy by using its own existing capabilities. Ayatollah Sayyid Khamenei said that efforts should be made to turn the Navy into a comprehensive and strategic force. He referred to the abundant capabilities that the country's naval forces possess, especially their capacity to assist in implementing seaborne economic policies. The leaders stressed the need to explore new capacities in order to enhance the country's strength. Ayatollah Khamenei hailed as remarkable and unbelievable the advances of the Navy since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The leader made those comments addressing naval commanders. November 28th marks the Navy Day in the Iranian calendar. Now, Iran calling an international criminal court to accelerate investigation of Israeli crimes in the Gaza Strip. In letters addressed to the court's head and prosecutor, the Iranian foreign minister described Israel's brutal atrocities in Gaza as clear instances of core international crimes. Hossein Mehmedullahian said that the perpetrators of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity must not go unpunished. The top diplomat noted the ICC's handling of Palestine case as a test of its independence and impartiality in the face of political pressure from certain world powers. He added that the support that Tel Aviv receives from those states has emboldened it to commit more crimes with impunity. Israel continues with its sporadic attacks on southern Lebanon amid cross-border tensions over the Israeli crimes in Gaza. In the latest assault, regime forces targeted a village there with artillery. We're early joined by Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh, who has more details.
Well, what we do know is that this artillery shell was fired at the outskirts of the village. It was somewhere away from the residential areas because you have a lot of people who went back to their town to check on their property and so on. And so it could have been something that would lead to the killing of civilians. But this artillery shell specifically fell on the outskirts. But this is not the first violation of the truce. If there is an embedded truce within the area of South Lebanon, which was, of course, during the past war, there was always a confrontation. But now we did see a truce in place. However, the Israelis continue to violate it. This is not the first time. Yesterday, we also had another bombs fired at the area of Blot, which is between the towns of Ramya and Ruhain. Today, we have Ait Ashab. We also had the firing of the fact that people they shot at certain civilian cars and also the UNIFIL.
Now, more rallies have been held worldwide in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Protesters are calling for a permanent ceasefire. In France, thousands have demonstrated in Lyon demanding an end to Israeli massacre of civilians in Gaza. In the Spanish city of Barcelona, people took to the streets voicing support for Palestinians while urging the extension of the four-day truce. Americans in New York City gathered in Manhattan, disrupting Black Friday shopping and chanting anti-Israel slogans. Police arrested some 30 people during the rally. Thousands also protested in Morocco's Casablanca, as well as the beachside city of Durban in South Africa. Demonstrators everywhere are calling for an end to the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. The Iranian capital, Tehran, is hosting a gathering of national and international scholars to review a letter written by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. The letter addressed the youths in Europe and the United States back in 2015. Salman Kujiri reports.
Scholars and thinkers have come together in a meeting at Tehran University to review a 2015 letter sent by Iran's leader to the youth in Europe and the United States. The meeting discussed how the leader's vision is finally being materialized in 2023. In the letter written in January of 2015, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei asked young people in the U.S. and Europe to attain first-hand knowledge of Islam. Ayatollah Khamenei asked youngsters not to allow the states to hypocritically introduce their own recruited terrorists as representatives of Islam. He also points out that with the mass development of social media, people can go beyond their geographical borders and try to view different cultures and religions objectively. Such pieces of advice from the leader have once again been brought to attention as the youth around the globe are showing interest in Islam after witnessing the resistance and faith of the Palestinian people in the face of the Israeli aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip.
Instead of money and materialistic possessions, the youth in Western nations can grab onto a more soothing and inclusive philosophy by forming affiliations with Islam.
Some other scholars call the leader's letter a fatherly address, aiming to uproot the xenophobia that oppressive states usually spread in a bid to justify their violence towards the people of a certain land or ethnicity.
The fact is that these letters were seeds that was put on the ground for it to grow and to sort of bring liberation and knowledge and awareness and awakening right across the world, especially with the children, with the youngsters, and youngsters in particular, because they are the future. The fact of the matter is that what has happened in the last month and a half since 7th of October reinforced and indeed brought into practice what the letter was trying to achieve. The awakening of people about the fact that Palestinians are the most oppressed and being deliberately massacre in front of our eyes, day in, day out.
Since October 7th, various Western media outlets have tried to justify Israeli crimes in Gaza. Accordingly, they have largely attempted to ignore the vast distress brought upon the 2.3 million people in Gaza in recent weeks. Young people, however, have been taking to the streets in support of Palestine in large numbers after finding out about Israeli atrocities through social media. One of the main goals behind the letter by the leader of the Islamic Revolution to the Western youth was to bypass Western media that do not present facts to their audience, society, as well as young people in Europe and the United States. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
And that report brings us to the end of this newscast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at Ireland and its love affair with Europe. In this post-Brexit era, how has Britain's departure from the EU affected the relationship between Old Blighty and its closest neighbours? What is the future for the north of Ireland? My next guest is a former member of the European Parliament, a former political prisoner, and current Sinn Féin politician. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1988. And today's guest is Martina Anderson. Martina is a woman well known not to mince her words on the political stage. A straight shooter, some would say. After serving 13 years as an IRA prisoner, Martina joined Sinn Féin, where she went on to become a member of the European Parliament. Martina Anderson, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So, Martina, could you tell me about your childhood growing up in Derry?
I would describe it as a child of the Battle of the Bogside. I lived in the row of houses, which has now got the iconic wall. You're now entering Free Derry. And by the age of 7, 1969, there had been 14 unionist bombs planted, electricity stations, RTE, water installations, and there were 6 people killed. And I come from a family of 10, and my older brothers and sisters had taken to the streets for one man, one vote, for civil rights, basic houses, jobs, what people were looking for. Most modest demands, one might say, and they were beat off the streets, as we all know. And it used to be written on the walls across Derry and across the north that the IRA equaled I ran away. There was no defence. The community was crying out for people to protect us against a state that neither wanted or welcomed us. So I grew up knowing that there was something rotten at the core of where I lived. I probably didn't have much of an understanding that it obviously was beyond Derry. It's a kind of environment that as a child I grew up in, and all of that had happened before Bloody Sunday.
And Martina, you then joined the IRA yourself, and you were then captured in England. Can you tell me about your capture and your time in jail there?
I'd previously been arrested in Derry, and I was in Armagh during the second hunger strike when that started. So I got bail, and I went on the run after 10 or 11 months. I attended every funeral of the hunger strikers that had taken place in 1981. And between that period and the period of my arrest, we will remain blank. I was arrested in Scotland along with Ella Dwyer and 3 other comrades. And we were charged, all of us were charged with conspiracy to cause explosions in England. And Pat McGee was charged separately with the Brighton bombing. So the 5 of us ended up in Brixton Prison. Ella and I were the only 2 women and 800 men. We didn't expect to be put on remand in Brixton Prison. When we rocked up that day and we were shouting goodbye to the others, saying we'd see them in court, we expected to go to a women's prison in Holloway. But they said it wasn't secure enough for us, and we ended up in Brixton Prison. Brixton Prison was a nightmare for 13 months. Apart from the Category A prisoners, and I do have to differentiate, because there were people that were from other backgrounds, you know, criminal backgrounds, who were Category A prisoners there. But they were caring individuals in relation to 2 women being among 800 men. For some of the other criminal population, it was appalling behaviour. So that was for 13 months of that. And then on top of it, we were strip searched. It first of all began 1 or 2 a day and ended up at 6 strip searches every day. So it was a very invasive sexual environment, you know, that you felt that you were held within. As well as that, it didn't bother me as much, the body searches. You were body searched at every move you made. Ella hated to touch on her body. I think because we were used to, and it shows you how you probably do get used to going through checkpoints and whatever and being searched. But Ella found that really offensive, how they would search us. And so between the body searches and the strip searches and the sexual abuse that we endured for 13 months, it was near impossible to prepare for your trial, because you're just trying to survive mentally. We knew that if we continued to react in the manner that we were acting, that's where it was going to lead. So we kept having to counsel ourselves, talk to ourselves, talk to each other, and take it in the chin. that this was it. And we thought that was as bad as it was going to get until we were sentenced and we moved from the fire in the frying pan, because we moved from Brixton Prison into Durham Jail.
And Martina, that sexual violence that you and Ella suffered in Brixton, it was bad enough what you suffered at the hands of other prisoners, but tell us a wee bit more about the strip searches. Would that have been one or two people carrying those out? Were there ever women involved in them? Or how many people would have been involved in a strip search, and what was that like?
You were put in the middle of a room and they circled you.
How many?
Six. Six screws. And they circled you. So when they circled you, they put you in the middle, like you were in a circus.
Six of them.
Six of them. And they would take off your clothes bit by bit. And they would make comments about your body. I remember one day, I literally came off a visit. I had that experience, put on my clothes, and I got to the cell door and they put their hand up. They says, now we're just going to strip you again because we're now going to do this as a cell search. I literally hadn't left the room. Mm-hmm. So we knew that they were physically and mentally trying to break us. Yeah. And it wasn't easy. You know, it wasn't an easy 13 months. It was a tough 13 months. And when we got to Durham, that was our first experience when we walked in the door again, was to be strip searched. We were strip searched when we left Brixton. We're put into the back of a van. We had in contact with nobody but screws. And we came into Durham and we were stripped again. So it continued throughout.
Were other prisoners in Durham, were the other women prisoners strip searched, or was that exclusive to you and Ella?
Generally speaking, because we were what they regarded as high-risk category prisoners, they subjected us to more strip searches than anyone in the jail, either in Durham or in Brixton. Even the men were not getting the same treatment as we were. So there was a sexual connotation attached to it, because it wasn't just something that they were going to apply to category prisoners, regardless of if you were a male or female.
So just moving forward a bit, and then your eventual release, Martina, you then joined Sinn Féin. Was that an easy transition after all those years in jail?
Yeah, it was a natural transition. We had followed the political process throughout. We were sent back here, transferred to prisons in Ireland 6 weeks before the first IRA cessation. I remember Martin had telling me that this was part of what the British were trying to do, to send a signal. And we had historical meetings with the ANC. The South Africans came to Longkesh Prison, and we women in Armagh were brought there. We were regularly updated about the peace and political process and what was going on in negotiations. As political prisoners, I was released under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. My husband, who I married in jail, it's another story, he had subsequently been released after me. Jack Straw tried to prevent him and two other men getting out, because they were the only prisoners that were subjected to natural life. They were never to be released. And so the natural corollary of me was to become involved in Sinn Féin. Was it to be an elected rep? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I toiled with going back to university. Going to university, I didn't have a university experience, but in prison I studied. We had a whole battle in our hands to be allowed to study and whatever, but I ended up getting a first class honours degree with an open university course. I went into jail with no academic qualifications, and I come out with a number of A levels and O levels, and then on to university degrees. We had no notions of going down and embarking upon that road. I always had seen myself as an activist, but very much as a non-elected activist, until Mary Nillis had stood down and I was to replace her, and I refused to do so. I was at that stage, my position in the All-Ireland coordinator, I was working on that. I had been working in the Assembly, and then And they used to slag me and say, I think she thinks she's Miss All-Ireland. I loved being in that position. And so I refused to go into the Assembly. And then Mitchell McLaughlin was moving to another constituency. And they asked me four times to stand. And I was not doing it. And then Mark McGuinness came and asked me. And we all know we don't say no to Martin.
And I worked with you and served alongside you in the Assembly, and you were brilliant and so hardworking and so across all the detail. But I thought you really shone when you went to Europe. You were a powerhouse in Europe, and I've credited you with the reason that the Europeans knew so much about Ireland and the implications that Brexit would have. So tell us about your time as an MEP, will you?
Barbara de Bruin stood down in 2012, unexpectedly and for personal reasons, and I had been a junior minister to Martin McGuinness, and one of the responsibilities that I had was Europe. So the party thought I knew a thing or two about Europe, and so did I. But I had no intentions of ever going to Europe, like to be an MEP, so they asked me to take it on, and again, one thing and another, you're persuaded to do it. So I goes over to Europe, and I thought, how am I going to make this place relevant to back here? So the first, I became involved in a lot of jargon like rapporteur and all that there. You know, it's a lead MEP that's in charge of the file. So the Tobacco Product Directive was something that I got my teeth into as one of the lead MEPs involved in that file. And it was I always try to develop a model, you know, how do I make Europe relevant? So I bring you to Europe and Europe to you. And it was about the amount of people that was dying from it and took on big tobacco, the big tobacco industry. They hated me. I went after them and everything that they had said and the lies that they had told about the product. If it was put on the market now, it wouldn't come on it because 50% of the people who use it die. So I did that and I got an experience with going to Palestine for the first time in 2013. And I suppose I would describe myself as a nationalist and an internationalist, and you know, I don't think internationalism should be in any way like a buzzword or, you know, a book token. You know, I do believe it's the fire that sort of connects communities struggling for something better, you know, across the world every day in every way. Coming from our experience of conflict in Ireland and going into Palestine, to the apartheid wall, demolitions, all that was taking place, and the deafening silence of the international community appalled me. And I had an opportunity in 2013 in Ramallah to be at, there was a tranche of prisoners being released. There was 26 prisoners being released, and I stood right into the middle of the morning waiting on the prisoners to come out. I remember crying, you know, just watching their families and everybody, just, just the emotion of it. So Thatcher's Children, as I call them, the Tory party, was engaging in a conversation publicly about a referendum and pulling out of the EU. We knew that this was bigger than them claiming to just take back control. We knew that this was about our rights, our entitlements, and this was going to dismantle the Good Friday Agreement and elements of the Good Friday Agreement if this went ahead. So the referendum, there was the Remain and the Leave, and it was two sides of the same coin because it was the Conservatives fighting among themselves. And we didn't officially take part, as you know, in any of the official campaigns, but we had our own Remain campaign. And we fought that here to explain to people why it was important that we be in the EU. We couldn't have some kind of a hokey-cokey arrangement that part of Ireland was in the EU, part of Ireland would be out of the EU, that the Good Friday Agreement, strand two of the Good Friday Agreement, the All-Ireland element of it, about alignment across this island, the whole issue of the economy, the All-Ireland economy, could not operate as it had been designed to do in the Good Friday Agreement if we were out of the EU. And thankfully, in constituencies after constituencies, we won the referendum in terms of not we, Sinn Féin, the people that was involved, everyone in Remain. But we know that in Britland, they decided in England that they wanted to leave and Scotland wanted to remain. So in Europe, after the referendum, the first thing happened was the first week there was the European Council. And Enda Kenny went over to the European Council and he waxed lyrical about Scotland, how Scotland had had a referendum and how the British government had told them if they leave the UK that they wouldn't have a place in Europe and how Europe had said that. But he was braveheart about Scotland and faintheart about Ireland. He never mentioned us. Now, he was a Taoiseach going into a council meeting. And MEP after MEP would come up to us and they asked us, time out of number, will there be another referendum in Scotland? Nobody was taking us on. They didn't give a fleeting glance, the British, to this. And neither did Europe, because Europe didn't understand the Good Friday Agreement in any of its parts. So I was the chair, I was the head of the Sinn Féin delegation. And one night, we knew we had to do something to try to be heard. And one night to an empty chamber, nobody in, Billy, no mates, myself and Matt Carthy sitting there, nobody else in the hall. And I get up and I used language that wasn't parliamentarian, as they would say, in terms of it should be used. But I told Theresa May that what she could do with her border and she could stick it where the sun doesn't shine, that she wasn't putting it here. And I told the EU that what armoured cars and tanks and guns couldn't do here, that the EU wasn't going to be able to do to the border in Ireland, because there are 310 crossings here. And if they thought that they were going to be able to put up what the Irish establishment started to present, which was a Swiss border type arrangement. So they were saying, bring the border down south more, into the south more, but that's where the checks would be done. So they were proposing all of these other kind of arrangements. And we had developed the special status for the north to remain within the EU. I went to my bed that night, that was it, and woke the next day to Sinn Féin telling me, don't answer your calls to any of the media, the phone. So I was, had speaking time the next morning again, and again it was about Brexit. So I went in and I remember my sister, she was scrubbing the floor. She sits in the house and she says, Nolan was going berserk about what I had said the night before. I didn't know this. And she says the next thing Nolan said, oh, she's on her feet again. Let's go live. And she says, your first words out of your mouth that morning was, we didn't start the war. The war came to us. And she said, oh no, she's going to be in real bother now. So the next thing, across Europe, they all wanted to understand, you know, in France and Italy and Spain and Portugal and Germany, why was this Irish MEP standing up in the European Parliament saying that to a British Prime Minister? No, that's not what you sort of do. So we couldn't cope with the fight. I couldn't for the volume of bids that was coming at myself. And Matt and I shared the, and we got to explain the peace process, got to explain the Good Friday Agreement, got to explain the fact that you couldn't have the Swiss-style border that the Irish was, you know, engaging people's brains on, that this might work, that you could have something similar here. That we're in Ireland, an Ireland economy, with the Good Friday Agreement, Strand 2 of the Good Friday Agreement. And bingo, they just went, Houston, we have a problem.
This week, we take a look at Brexit, a concept presented with great hope for the British public. But what went wrong? Was this a major miscalculation on the part of patriotic politicians, or a more sinister attempt by a few to enrich themselves while making economic slaves of the working class for many years to come?
In 2016, the UK voted to leave the EU, its closest and biggest trading partner, before officially leaving the trading bloc on the 31st of January 2020. During the referendum campaign, Vote Leave made a series of pledges about what would happen if Britain voted to quit the EU and negotiated a new relationship. After the Brexit process claimed two prime ministers, Vote Leave ended up running the UK government. Its figurehead, Boris Johnson, and its top advisor, Dominic Cummings, leading the charge for change. But what was promised and what was gained? If we look at some of the key promises, including trade deals, the NI border with Ireland, ending supremacy of EU law, taking control of the immigration issue, and the £350 million promised to the NHS, we are only led to one conclusion. The British public have been had. A recent study by the London School of Economics found that Brexit was responsible for about a third of UK food price inflation since 2019, adding nearly $7 billion to Britain's grocery bill. Post-Brexit and the persistent poverty rate for the UK was 7.8%, the eighth lowest in the European Union and 3.5 percentage points lower than the EU 28 average rate of 11.3%. All this while the wealth of the UK's billionaires has skyrocketed by over 1,000% between 1990 and 2022, ballooning by around $600 billion. The number of billionaires exploded from 15 in 1990 to 177 this year. Between 2020 and 2022 alone, billionaire wealth increased by almost $150 billion. While the working class pick up the pieces yet again, it seems that some have never had it better.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildernew, alongside our special guest, Sinn Féin politician, Martina Anderson.
So, Martina, it's difficult not to mention the current impasse at Stormont. Some parties have blamed Brexit and the disagreements around the protocol, but how do you see that stalemate and how do you think Brexit has changed the political landscape here?
Well, whilst Brexit has been an unmitigated disaster, the DUP's handling of it, I think for their own constituency and from where they're coming at this from, in terms of wanting to maintain the union, I think that they will go down in history as being the people that has successfully broke it up from inside out.
Well, Martina, it's always good seeing you. We want to thank you for coming on the show and we look forward to seeing you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Martina Anderson, and our resident co-host, Michelle Gildernew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran. And we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Dear listeners, brothers and sisters, as we said, there are different objectives for the supplications. Reciting each of these supplications will grant us insight different than the other. One of the most important objectives is the practical and ethical instructions found in these supplications, and this is not something that could be denied. This is especially true regarding something like Sahifatul Sajjadiyyah. And one of the factors which led to these instructions in the language of supplication was the situation at the time of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam that we discussed in the previous episode. We said that we will refer to some of the instructions of these infallible imams that are embedded in these supplications. For example, in Sahifatu Sajjadiyya, in the 24th supplication, special attention is paid towards parents. Now, the 26th supplication, for example, this is what deals with the education of children. How to educate children and what their rights are is totally discussed in this 26th supplication. In this part of the supplication, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has ordered the parents to pray for their children. He has ordered them to take much care of them. They are not to indulge in the wrong assumption that their only task is to provide food, clothing, shelter, medicine, etc., and to send them, for example, to schools or to high schools. Rather, the focal attention, based on the words of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, should be on educating them. And at the same time, in this supplication, it is talked about the ideal children. Should it be enough for them to be only literate, or should it suffice them to be healthy or wealthy? Are these factors enough? I mean, are there other factors as well? And Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has issued comprehensive commands concerning these issues. We'll be back after a short break.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javob onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good, about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too, it's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So as we said, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in the 26th supplication is discussing how the parents should educate their children, what the rights of the children are. So Imam Sajjad alayhi salam in this form of educational text, it could be said, but in reality, nothing can be seen except dua and supplication. Imam says, وَأَسِحَّ لِي أَبْدَانَهُمْ وَأَدْيَانَهُمْ وَأَخْلَاقَهُمْ. Oh my God, I pray to you to keep their bodies healthy, which is referring to the children. Imam says, أَسِحَّ لِي أَبْدَانَهُمْ. Oh Allah, keep my children's bodies healthy. وَأَدْيَانَهُمْ وَأَخْلَاقَهُمْ. To preserve their ethics and faith. And Imam says, grant me with their sustenance, وَأَدْرِرْ لِي, and make them well-doers, وَجْعَلْهُمْ أَبْرَارًا, make them pious, make them discerning and obedient to you. وَجْعَلْهُمْ أَبْرَارًا, أتقياء بصراء سامعين مطيعين لك. Obedient to you, and not just to you, and ولأوليائك. And of course, followers and lovers of your guardians, make them hate and dissent from your foes. And Imam continues, assist me to bring them up and educate them well. أعني تربيتهم وتأديبهم وبرهم. Help me in educating them well. Guard me and my children against the Satan. وأعذني وذريتي من الشيطان الرجيم فإنك خلقتنا وأمرتنا ونهيتنا ورغبتنا في الثواب ما أمرتنا ورهبتنا عقابه. O Allah, you have made the reward of carrying out your orders desirous to us. You have warned us of the punishment of not obeying your orders. And as we see, dear listeners, in this supplication, the two objectives, I mean, introducing the ideal children and the way of educating children are thoroughly dealt with. And Imam is teaching us how we should educate our children. And Imam is at the same time warning us about the rights of the children. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my son, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, now I offer my son to you. See, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you, you who have my roots. Tears and your brother's cry have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Some of thee inside my aching heart, some of thee inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Health Organization warning that more people could die from diseases than Israeli bombings in Gaza if the health system is not rapidly restored. Israel and the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas are expected to release more prisoners and captives under an extended truce deal in Gaza. Israeli forces kill more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, pushing the death toll from the regime's raid since early October to 230. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Zarifi. Good to have you with us. The World Health Organization is calling for quick efforts to restore the health system in Gaza that has been devastated by weeks-long